I'm Dane Brugler. I cover the NFL draft for The Athletic. Our draft guide picked up the name The Beast because of the crazy amount of information that's included. I'm looking at thousands of players, putting together hundreds of scouting reports. I've been covering this year's draft since last year's draft. There is a lot in The Beast that you simply can't find anywhere else. This is the kind of in-depth, unique journalism you get from The Athletic and The New York Times. You can subscribe at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your jump on the work, don't let the work jump on you. Of music, news, and criticism, I'm John Caramonica, critic of the New York Times.
I'm Joe Coscarelli, a reporter at the New York Times.
It's Sinners Week on Popcast, the number one film.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time this comes out, presumably for another weekend of huge box office. Sinners is the new Ryan Coogler film. It stars Michael B. Jordan as a set of twins. It focuses on, dare I say, a crossroads of a sort. It is a story about blues. It is a story about white thievery of black art. It's a vampire and horror film, two genres which I will confess up front, I'm not that familiar with, but Joe is. We're going to talk a lot about Sinners, the film, and at the very end, we're also going to get into a tiny bit of the music with another guest. But in the room with us today, to my left, it's Wesley Morris, critic at large, New York Times. Wesley?
Hi. Only the music at the end?
No, we'll do
the
it.
Music
we'll do it.
Throughout, yes. But we're going to zoom in on the blues.
We're okay. Zoom in at the end.
With a cameo.
Oh. Is it Christone?
It's not. Also with us, it's Reggie Ogwu, our culture reporter who interviewed Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan in advance of this film. Reggie, long time since you've been on the show.
Too long.
That's fair enough. Fair enough. We'll never let that go. We'll never let that happen again.
Only a big tent vampire film can bring us all together, especially if it's about the risks of signing to a major label.
Yes. We opened with I Lied to You. This is a song sung in the film by Sammy, Preacher Boy Sammy, played by a relative newcomer, Miles Caton, who Reggie informed me before we started recording, sang back up for her.
Mm-hmm. A blessed voice, I think. Like, good for
incredible
her.
Incredible voice.
Yeah.
And a strong actor as well,
yeah.
Apparently.
So, we're going to talk about the blues, clearly, but we should talk about filmmaking. This is a very expensive movie.
That's why our
movie.
Film experts are
yeah,
here.
Yeah, but this is a very expensive movie. When we sat down earlier, Joe, you and I, you asked me what my first takeaway. And my first takeaway was this is a wild way for Hollywood to spend $90 million. This is a very unusual big ticket Hollywood film. There's a number of things happening stylistically. A number of different styles of film are happening and in some places perhaps colliding. It's also a superstar vehicle for Michael B. Jordan, like one of the most bankable and successful and sometimes versatile actors.
I would put an asterisk next to all of those things.
Right, okay. We want, let John finish
fine.
and then you correct him. That's what you're here for.
Totally it's fine. Not factually wrong.
Fine.
It's just
I'm not pressed.
It's complicated.
Can you guys talk, Reggie, maybe you want to start, having sat with the two kind of like real life protagonists here, can you talk a little bit about how the project came to be and why it has the shape that it has?
Yeah, so this is Ryan Coogler's first, truly original film that he's made, written, and directed. His first feature, Fruitvale Station, he also wrote, but it was based on a real story.
Mm-hmm.
The real life of Oscar Grant, who was killed by police in Oakland. And then obviously he did Creed, which was a very successful and relatively original, but retooling of an existing franchise in the Rocky movies, which he leveraged into directing the first Black Panther movie. Obviously, we know what that did. And then he did Wakanda Forever. So this is his fifth feature, but first time where it's IP that he is creating. And, you know, you can assume that coming from that lineage, he didn't want to take a step back, right? Like, he's like, I'm going to make as big of a statement with this film as I have with these other people. People have come to expect a certain thing from me. I'm going to deliver on that. I've also heard him talk about, you know, the content of this movie and the story that he's telling and the themes of the blues and the legacy of this music and the people who created it and were sort of disempowered, impoverished, weren't able to participate, profit from the fruits of their labor and their creation, and feeling like he wanted to give it the biggest canvas possible. He talked about being mentored by Spike Lee and learning about his experience with Malcolm X, a movie about another outsized figure that deserved the biggest canvas possible. And yet Spike struggled to finance that movie. Mm-hmm. Had to go to Oprah, had to go to Michael Jordan, had to go to these various people to get funding. And so in his mind, if he has an opportunity to tell this very important story, he wanted to make it as big and as splashy and use the biggest cameras and get as much money as he possibly could.
As a sidebar, is that in and of itself a victory, that this subject matter, this film, this director, this star, that the studio system says, great, yes, we have this money? Is that in and of itself a kind of victory?
It could be solely for Ryan. I think what makes it actually a victory is if the movie is received well, the movie that performs well, if it inspires other people to get work and be able to achieve similar things, that's success. If you get those things and the movie sucks or the movie tanks, I don't know that you would call that necessarily a win for anyone other than Ryan, who also got first dollar gross on this movie, so he's getting paid either way. But I think what makes it an actual success is that you could see it leading to more work, not only for him, but for other filmmakers.
Well, I kind of want to flip that on its head, which is to say, should it be a miracle that somebody who's made Disney billions of dollars gets to make a movie he wants to make? Like, the fact, and I think we should do a little plot summary here, but like the fact that when he got the opportunity to make a movie, and $90 million sounds like a lot of money. Not that much money. For a studio film, for somebody with the track record that Ryan Coogler has, which is...
He spent more money.
Yes.
To make movies.
Right.
But also, I would say that Ryan Coogler at this particular moment is... This is his imperial period, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is... I don't know what his process is like. I don't know if it was hard for him to get this realized. From an industry standpoint, I definitely know the knives were out before opening weekend about this alleged a lot of money that was spent to make it and how
it and whether could, or not it was earning
it could
back.
Change the yeah. way movies get financed,
mm-hmm.
Negatively change how movies get financed if the movie doesn't work or whatever. But this, in the scheme of the way the movies work, is a person at the height of his clout making a, like, in the scheme of the way the industry currently works, and the based on the movies he's made, this is a personal movie that is also like a pop movie that has, you know, him operating according to a sensibility that a lot of directors either don't have in them or is rare for them to be able to express, which kind of moves him into some interesting... It's funny because this movie is not in any way like the directors I'm about to name. But in terms of our response to it and the number of people I know who either have seen it more than once already or plan to see it again, it's a Spielberg, Shyamalan, Jordan Peele-like echelon of movie-going experience. But the movie itself, to me... I mean, this is going to sound like a dig, but I ultimately think it is. I'm saying this in praise in a weird way. It's really a Mario Van Peebles movie.
Okay.
Right. It is operating according to the revisionist priorities that Mario Van Peebles was thinking through with respect to gangster movies and westerns. Mario Van Peebles being Melvin Van Peebles' son, but also the director of New Jack City and Posse, first of all, and the star of many, many television shows. But this movie feels to me personal as a matter of Black Hollywood filmmaking, in addition to all of the sort of national American historical iconography and cultural development that has gone on for the last, you know, I'm going to say 400 years just to save myself some math, but like for 400 or so years.
And all of the tensions that you're describing are in many ways what the movie is about. Now, at least for me, it was very hard not to see this entire movie as a comment on what it has been like to be Coogler in this Hollywood system, making corporate IP, selling blackness via corporate IP, specifically in Black Panther and its sequel, but also in Creed, making the Rocky movie into a black story. And that comes here in the form of like a historical drama. So let's just say what this movie is about on the surface, which is it's a tale of Mississippi under Jim Crow. It's two brothers, both played by Michael B. Jordan, Smoke and Stack, returning home to Clarksdale with ill-gotten goods from their time in Chicago working for Al Capone.
Prohibition era.
Yes, Prohibition era. And it's about them wanting to open a nightclub, a juke joint, and getting both their young cousin, Miles Kahan, who we heard at the beginning, who's a preternaturally talented blues singer and
in the movie,
son of a preacher.
Yeah, you are talking about the world of the movie.
Yes. but both. And then also an old timer, and then the encroachment on their club on the first night, the opening night of their juke joint.
On their freedom, the encroachment on their freedom.
On their freedom and on their music and culture by curious assimilationists, a.k.a. Irish vampire named Remick, who wants access to their music and their stories and is basically saying, let's be immortal together, a.k.a. sign on the dotted line
make
here
hits.
And, you know, we'll put out your first five albums and see what happens.
And I mean, and it presents white intrusion, white observation as like a literal contagion. Like once the movie develops into the second part of what the film is,
yes.
It literally treats whiteness as a contagion.
And it's also crucial to note that there's a sort of C plot happening here, which, you know, or there'll be some spoilers, I imagine, in this conversation.
This is a pro-spoiler podcast.
Yeah,
it's like,
so
if you haven't
seen
before,
Sinners,
this is a pro-spoiler
podcast. Go to the movie theater, buy your
ticket.
It's
been 2 weeks.
Yes.
I am spoiling nothing. You guys can go.
All right.
Sorry, we'll do all the spoiling.
Yes, so what I'm saying is there are two kinds of white people in this movie, and they both are trying to feed on blackness in different ways and at different levels.
And the movie can tell which is what, too, which
yes.
I think is very important.
So there is a KKK subplot here. There is a, I'll call it an Inglourious Bastards ending, one of the many endings of this movie. But there's the idea of white on black violence in its plainest, mm-hmm. most, you know, visceral and literal terms. And then there is the perhaps more insidious version of appropriation and exploitation. And that's being, there are vampires in this movie and there are regular old
plain old racist
Ku Klux Klan members.
Plain old KKK. Right.
So I'm curious to know, Wesley, how you thought all of these ideas are threaded together, starting with the idea of blues being the sort of antithesis to the black church, and then that growing into these various other tributaries. There's a lot of ideas in this movie.
It's a lot of movie.
It's a lot of movie.
A lot of movies.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is, I mean, it's also important to say that we're dealing with different layers of meaning. From the standpoint of both text and subtext, plot and narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And the most successful moments in the movie are when many of those things are operating at once. The vampires as minstrel metaphors is maybe the strongest, most vivid and maybe even hilarious idea here.
Do you want to say more about them as minstrels? I think that's really important. Like this idea of taking these kind of folk songs and reappropriating them.
Well, I mean, it's funny because when they, so the juke joint gets built. Then one of when I'm talking about Spielberg and Shyamalan and Peele, which is a crazy thing. I love that I can just say Peele now and it like need something like Spielberg and Shyamalan. There is this great hour. I wrote it. It's like 40 minutes of them setting up of the juke joint.
Getting together.
It could have been, according to the montage we get at the end, that beautiful setup could have gone on for another 12 minutes, right? Because they condense all of the sort of procedural and infrastructural work.
It was almost like barn raising. They sort of like skipped.
Yeah, they skipped.
Like could see that they brought all those
people. Where'd all the garlic come from?
Yes.
Who fried all that chicken?
Yeah.
Like you get all of that in a montage that comes after the fact.
And you meet the characters that are going to do those tasks. You meet the Chinese grocer couple. You meet the love interest who's going to be the chef for the evening.
The worker who's going to be the bodyguard. Yep.
There's what I'm going to describe in the world of the movie, a high yellow sister who gets off a train and is immediately like, you didn't F me the way I wanted to be effed, or you effed me and you left, and I want some more effing. F you.
7 years later.
That person is played.
7 years later. Like, that's...
Yes.
That's memorable.
Listen, and it... Listen, I have seen those... Is it Google ads? Is it Amazon ads where Michael B. Jordan is, like, being the voice of the tech? You've not seen these?
No.
He's in the bathtub... I think he's in the bathroom while a woman's in the bathtub. I mean,
totally normal.
Everybody knows what Michael, like, everybody wants a piece of that.
But not everyone knew they wanted a piece of Haley Steinfeld.
This is an
burst
important,
into adulthood with this role.
This is an important movie for her in a lot of ways, right? This is a person who was, when she got the True Grit nomination, 2011, someone had done reporting about her ancestry and who her mother was, who's Susan Conner. I don't know if it's her mother. I don't remember now. But she is like the child of the star of one of the great melodramas in Hollywood history, Imitation of Life. And she, when they were trying to do this tally of updating the number of Black people nominated for Academy Awards, Haley Steinfeld was floated, and I mean, she was a girl when this happened, right? She would have been like 13 or 14. So they threw her name out, and I don't remember who tried to walk back or deny that it was true. But she had been assumed by skin folk to have been a Black woman. So her embrace of this part and all that it is asking for her to say and do just feels, I was very moved by it.
She's not on the Wikipedia page, list of Black Academy Award winners and nominees.
Well, listen, check back on Monday.
Wikipedia, for all our listeners, it's an unofficial source. We do not consider
her maternal grandfather was half Filipino, half Black.
When True Grit came out, there was an attempt to say that Haley Steinfeld had Black ancestry.
Wow.
And that she should be considered one of the Black Academy Award nominees. And it's interesting to me to watch this movie and see her fully embrace a role that had, in my mind, had been, or a possibility that had some speculation around it.
Mm-hmm.
And she is now owning that and making it part of this press cycle, which is like, I'm more in touch with my ancestry now via this movie, which happens to mirror my real life.
I assume IRL. Something yep. like that was going on. Okay. This feels like a coming out in some way.
Yes.
Both as grown and sexy and as not white.
Right.
Or not only white.
Reggie,
but anyway,
I hear you getting these quiet darts off. I hear you. Don't think we don't hear you. It's an audio medium.
I do think
It's been a minute.
It is crucial to this movie and to the minstrelsy point that Reggie was asking about, that the white passing people in this movie are not purely white devils. They are, in fact, an Irish immigrant and a white passing black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And a lover, you know, like the romantic interest of one of the main, you know, like.
Yes, and it's crucial when she shows up to the juke joint for the party and they're like, ma'am, I think you've
made a mistake.
Yeah. And she's like, no, I didn't.
Actually, you've made, yes.
Yeah.
And she has ties to that community, which are very clear. And
everybody knows her. She is known. Yeah.
She's like,
she's called
about
family.
Me,
she's what she's called. Yeah. They literally call her family.
She's family.
I do think the Irishness of Remick, the vampire character played by Jack O'Connell, is really important and interesting, because it's not a straight white vampire bloodsucker narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, it's someone who has Irish ancestry, which is, has its own, obviously,
history
of oppression, et cetera.
History of oppression and of music. At this time in America, the Irish people are only kind of becoming white in the way we think of whiteness today.
Shout out Noel Ignatiev. Yeah.
Yeah, these are very deliberate choices.
In the, and then I think the most interesting thing to me about the film is that it quickly becomes not white vampires versus these black people.
No.
What they're up to is something else. And Remick has these lines where he's like, can't we all just get along?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, let's do this together.
Be a family.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We believe in equality. He literally says, we on this side, we believe.
We're not like those KKK freaks. Right.
And you read that as sincerity, or you read that as manipulation?
I probably manipulation, but very seductive.
Yeah.
Very seductive. And,
well, it works.
Right.
And eventually they do become quite the post-racial
collective. Like,
you know, you have the Chinese immigrants there, you've got the black people there, you've got the white people there, they've got that Irish jig that looks fire. Right.
So, I want to zoom in on that. Yeah. We're going to get to the sort of big centerpiece dance scene that is sort of the thesis statement of this movie, but there's the bookends of the white music, where when the vampires first try to enter the juke joint, they say, we're just here to play a little song. And they play Will Ye Go, Lassie Go. Mm-hmm. Maybe we just want to hear a little bit of that, because it's, dare I say, sauceless.
And we'll all go together to pull wild mountain time.
Well, here's, all right.
You're not wrong. I'm not correcting.
No. So we come back, and even in the moment when they play it, one of the twins is sort of like, I'm not mad at this, but it's not right for what we're doing here moment.
Does one of the twins say it?
Yeah. Stack.
Because
I believe it's the one who eventually joins the party.
Okay, I was going to say, like, it was either Omar Miller or one of the twins, because
I think they all sort of are like, these people can
that
play.
One, that one is a step up from the Pick, Pull, Robin, Clean song, which was extremely white and bumpkin sounding. And then Wild Mountain Time is a little bit more soul.
Yes, so then that's what I was getting at, which is that then once they start picking off people, including
the music.
The music evolves,
and then all of a sudden they have a little rhythm, they have a little swag, and their party gets bigger and better. And when they do the full vampire ensemble number outside, where everyone is like it looks like Bonnaroo, and it looks like lit, you know. And that's the
Post Malone after party,
and that's the temptation, and that
that's
I think
the
is like, and I do think Coogler, as somebody who has worked inside of the system and is very clear about his Gemini-ness and how he contains both of these twins in him.
I don't speak astrology.
Well, you know, this is also a Kendrick Lamar thing. Coogler sees a lot of harmony with Kendrick and his work, and two Gemini guys trying to be like, I'm both, basically. Mm-hmm. I'm both of these things. I want peace and I want to fight, you know, in the Kendrick mode, in the GNX mode. But I think that he is presenting this option of collaboration or assimilation as sincerely inviting to the point where one of the characters follows through on that path.
Except there is a sort of formal or genre problem here, which is that the person offering this invitation is a vampire, right?
Right.
And so the ulterior motive is it completely overwhelms any legitimate appeal to member to like become a member, right? So that felt
except
meaningful
the part where you can
me,
live
right?
forever.
I mean,
yeah, and also it sort of posits that at least for some people in the Juke Joint, the prospect of living in this, I don't want to say post-racial, because it's not post-racial, but multiracial.
Yes.
Living forever, a little bit of an Irish jig and a little bit of a blues song. For some people, whatever decision they're choosing to make, that's a preferable choice.
And the only downside is you don't get to see the sun, you know.
I mean,
honestly, I barely see the sun ever.
And you give up your culture, which importantly, right. Mumi Misako's character is intent. I think it's really notable. Yes.
She's like kill me.
Yeah.
I'm not going over there.
I'm not going over there, no matter how good it looks. I'm not going to sacrifice my culture.
And I'm interested in her as the sort of, you know, conscience of the movie.
Right.
Because the movie also struck me as quite anti-Christian, I want to say, which was basically like... Richard Brody, our pal, called it provocatively Africanist, which I think is another good way to put it, which is
yes. The
movie and therefore... You know, I felt like it was Coogler speaking through these characters was very much like, you know, don't believe in these binaries about the blues being the devil's music, which is what you learn in the Christian church, but cling to your hoodoo, to your African culture, to your religions from before religion was forced on you by these white people, basically, and that is where you can find actual purity.
I also think that there is, it's like deeper and blacker than that.
Tell me.
Very complicated, right? Because on the one hand, we don't get to where we are in American popular music without the black church, period. But as an institution, right, the function of the church in black social life was restrictive. It was suppressive. It was repressive. It was hypocritical. It was judgmental. It was fear-mongering. And it was designed in one of the more generous readings of the way the church functioned. All of that prohibition was protective, mm-hmm. right? It was
which
to
you
keep,
see in the Saul Williams well,
that's,
character.
That's how it's presented
the
as
father
well.
To Preacher Boy Sammy.
It's to keep the devil out.
Right. If you
but
keep
at the same
dancing
time,
with the devil, he's going to follow you home.
But... Within those restrictions, there are all kinds of hypocrisies that take place. The movie doesn't explicate that, but there's something quite clear in the detachment between father and son, right? The father is not interested in his son as a child of him. He's interested in his son as a child of God. And the way that all of the sort of spiritual medicine works is very visceral, right? Like this woman is a sensual person. She is of the earth, wants to stay like low to the earth. The function of the dark-skinned black women in this movie is like they're both on the ground, like in a meaningful ways throughout this movie. And I don't know. I don't know. I want to come back to this minstrel idea though, because one of the best shots in the movie is when this trio, like Mumford and Sister, like
shout out to Lola Kirk, by the way, another white trash classic role,
yes.
reprising her brief appearance in Gone Girl.
And also a singer. She has a music career, so to speak.
Yep.
She
she makes some alt country music.
She does music.
I did not know that until right now.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Precise Mozart outputs. In the Jungle Hive, anyone?
Ugh. I forgot about that.
I forgot about that show, and thanks a lot. But there's this great shot where they're walking toward the house, and I was kind of like, what? I knew what was going to happen. I was like, somebody's got a banjo. Somebody's holding a violin, and what would the third instrument be? And it's a guitar.
Mm.
But I loved that because the metaphor kind of completes itself and it explains itself. You don't have to hit it too hard. I think where the movie gets into trouble is it is following at some point three different logics, right? You've got vampire movie logic. You've got the history of American popular music logic. Mm-hmm. You've got the logic, the truth, the fact, historical fact of Blacks and Irish people. Mm-hmm. And then you just have the actual narrative needs of the movie.
Yeah, like almost like the, dare I say, the buddy comedy of like the first 30 to 40 minutes, especially once they all start pulling people into the car and like, let's hell build
smoke
this
and
thing.
Stack getting split up and then having to come back together.
Right, so great 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And again, it's I explained this to Joe earlier, but as someone that doesn't watch a lot of horror and doesn't watch a lot of vampire movies, like I didn't realize that that was set up for the siege.
Right.
That I didn't know. But that's, you know.
What I was saying to John is I feel like if you're conversant in the genre conventions that Coogler is borrowing from widely and intentionally, then it's less of a surprise when you get the twist, I think, of it becoming a siege movie because you know, okay, if they're all going to be in one place, like if you've seen From Dusk Till Dawn or, you know, movies like this where it's all leading to this big encounter, even like I was thinking of Straw Dogs the whole time, you know, where it's like
Night
eventually,
of the Living Dead.
Eventually you're going to be in a place and you're going to be fighting off the outsiders, which you get a little hint of when the vampire first appears and he's trying to come into the home of Lola Kirk and her Ku Klux Klan husband and needs the invitation. And then you start saying, okay, he's using these old timey rules. A vampire must be invited in. You know, there's the garlic burning off their skin, etc. But yes, there is this pivot and it comes crucially, I think, after he says what he wants to say about the sanctity of Black music and its through lines, both in the past and in the future.
I agree.
We're going to take a quick break because it is time for the song of the week. Car critic, whip appeal.
AKA.
A lot of AKAs. This week, it's a Doechii song. And I want to say, quite thankfully, it's not the Doechii song that's incredibly popular right now, which is Anxiety. And you'll understand why when you listen to the segment. But this week in the car, it's Nosebleeds by Doechii. You can see the whole video on Instagram and TikTok at Popcast. You can see it on, you can see it on my personal Instagram if that's where you're choosing to look for things.
YouTube.com/Popcast.
100%.
Get in on those shorts.
Subscribe at all of those places. Let's check out the song of the week. We'll be right back.
You heard the new Doechii song? Get in. Let's talk about it.
I guess we'll never know. Will she lose her cool? I guess we'll never die.
The name in pop that you have heard the most in the last few months undoubtedly is Doechii. Doechii won Best Rap Album at the Grammys. Her album, which came out in August, was one of the most discussed of last year. The song that's getting played the most right now is Anxiety.
Somebody's watching me. Is my anxiety.
Anxiety was a fan favorite from the COVID era that never was properly released. To me, Nosebleeds, which she released after she won the Grammy Award, is a far more revealing song. You really hear all the corners and contours of her influences in what she's doing on this song.
We'll never decked out the swamp to the motherfucking stage. Cut my mic off because I'm about to misbehave.
Doechii had plenty of singles last year, but sometimes they struck me as almost like overly theatrical. One of the things I like so much about Nosebleeds is it has grit. It's direct. You hear what a student she is of rapping and rappers. Because of that, Nosebleeds is like a micro hip hop history lesson.
Guess we'll never know. Guess we'll never see the day that Doechii crown falls.
Doechii reminds me a tremendous amount of the Native Tongues era. The production, this feels like A Tribe Called Quest, circa 1993. You're also hearing a lot of Nicki Minaj in this. There's this thing that Doechii does with one of her syllables where she goes, ah, and that's extremely Nicki Minaj coded. There's a joy and an exuberance. She's shit talking on this song. It's the type of record you make when nobody thought you were gonna be on top and then you find yourself on top and think,
right now is my time, my moment.
I'm Brian Rosenthal. I'm an investigative reporter at the New York Times. My dad is a scientist.
My career has been devoted to scientific teaching and research.
I remember growing up, I didn't fully understand what he was doing every day. But now that I work as an investigative journalist, I do understand.
So you have to start with facts. From those facts, a hypothesis appears. And then you work on trying to test that hypothesis.
I do the same thing, obtaining documents, crunching the data, and I've talked to as many people as possible to get to the bottom of the story. The New York Times does not publish until we can prove that something is true. The best scientists are able to do that deep work because they receive funding from their university or from the government. We as journalists depend on funding from subscribers. You can support that type of work by subscribing to the New York Times.
We are back. It's Popcast, the Sinners episode. I'm here. Joe's here. Reggie's here. Wesley's here.
Can we talk about that scene?
Which one?
The scene. The Bootsy Collins.
Oh,
Mom
no.
Mom K.
Yeah. Whatever yes, would the, that mean,
the
Joe?
Linda Martell scene. Right, the Linda Martell interlude sequence is how I was thinking about it. Like the thing that makes Cowboy Carter, the one thing for me about it that makes it a little frustrating.
Genre
that everybody,
is a funny thing.
I mean, it is the thing that it doesn't need because it already is that thing.
Yes.
And to have two different lectures happening simultaneously about what the blues is complete, and then to have it literalized during these two explanations I wanted to find it beautiful. I should have been moved by it, but I was much more frustrated by the literalization and personification of its allegories and metaphors.
I enjoyed that scene, but I also felt a little bit of those frustrations as well, as it is, I mean, it's extremely literal, but it's also, I think it's such a beautiful thing that's represented.
It's a great idea.
It's a great idea. I think there's a lot of truth in that scene, but you just can't get over how odd it is to see people twerking and the boots and electric guitar crumping.
Yeah, so, I mean, and here's my complaint. Like, it's like, I could have dealt with the heavy-handedness, with the on-the-noseness of it, especially, like, we're primed for it. Like you said, like, this is also the thesis statement of Cowboy Carter, which is, like, not only is country music my music and I have this right to it, but everything that came before and after, right? So then you're seeing
but
this
also
montage.
All music that Black people sing is country music.
Yes.
Is her argument.
Yes.
And the album argues that without having to dissertate.
And so this gets teased in the opening of the movie, which is a montage about African griots and people who can summon their ancestors and their progeny via music. And then you have Preacher Boy Sammy's triumphant performance in the juke joint, and then everyone is summoned, and you see a funk guitarist, you see a DJ.
Felt like a book report.
Yeah, well, and so here's what the thing, though. I think I could have gone with it if it was more aesthetically
pleasing.
The ripoff Bootsy, and I was like, why isn't his costume better? Like, you know, like, and then you get and then it's a b-boy, and then it's a crumper and a twerker and a, you know, and then you get the Chinese dancers to represent the Chinese grocer.
Yeah. Some native dancers, I think, in there.
The Judith Jameson kind of like.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I went straight to Misty Copeland.
All of that, but it's not beautiful.
No. So this is, I'm glad you're saying
it's
this.
It's not like the Tree of Life, you know what I mean?
Right.
Where I can deal with the dinosaurs because I'm like in the moment.
Right. I think if they had chosen to turn that into a sequence, like a true better choreographed, I guess, because there is choreography, but mostly it's the camera and the effects doing the work. I would have loved to see something as beautiful and as like strange as the movie's actual great musical number, right? Which is, that's part of what makes it great too. Like, I know what's happening here, but it also defies easy description. I'm talking about the later number where once they've turned enough of the juke joint goers into vampires, they now have
the outdoor one, the Bonnaroo one that I was talking about.
Yes, yes. For drinking to hear the lassie smile, laughing all the while at me curious style, could set your heart
one, two, three, four, five. Hug the hair and turn her down the rocky road and all the way.
That's an extraordinary sequence for how uncomfortably good it is, which, you know,
it's not a lecture.
No, it's not a lecture.
It's more
and it
subtle
is,
than the one that precedes it.
The movie is challenging you to figure out for yourself.
They're kind of good now, huh?
What is pleasurable about yeah. this? But I have to say the setup for that is the thing we talked about earlier when the person in the juke joint that I believe you guys that it's not Omar Miller, that it is one of the Michael B. Jordans. But it doesn't matter because one of those two people, both of them turn into vampires. Oh, God.
They
join
the
spoilers.
They join the crew. Yeah.
Right. But it is so us to be like, you know what? They're actually not bad. we are generous to our own demise. Like some of this is our fault because we're good people. Ultimately,
this is like the Jack Harlow conundrum.
We recognize talent no matter what form it takes. If it wants to eat us, I will keep a steak in hand. Mm. But I gotta just say, these people are not bad. I gotta give my due.
And actually, in that
second, don't you?
That was violence. That was violence.
How dare you whisper it like you can't, Tina Marie?
But the thing in that second musical number that you're talking about, the moment that actually sold it for me, because in the beginning you're not seeing Stack.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing the band, like you're seeing the white band, the Irish band, and then you see Mary. And then there's a moment
where Stack kind of
like emerges from behind them and kind of gives this incredibly winning smile. Yeah.
Once he's a vampire.
Yes, once he's a vampire, yes. And he gives this incredibly winning smile. And just for a minute, you're like, oh, that's where my allegiances are. If he's having a great time, I should be.
And I felt like Coogler was saying, like, I did pretty good at Black Panther.
This
you know?
This feels good, even though it's obviously deadly and raw.
Right. Mm.
And to have one of the Michael B. Jordans not just reveling, but like right next to this guy, he's like,
party.
Like Cobaining out, right? That felt, I mean, Cobain's probably like, we got to pick somebody better than that. Like Jack Whiting out, right?
Wow. There you go. That's better.
Like just, I don't know. I really love the difficulty of that, the complexity of it, the honesty of it. I love that it's not easy or even clear what is like morally going on, let alone allegorically going on here. I love that because that's the truth, right? The truth is murk. The truth is weird, and it's uncomfortable in the pleasurableness that comes out of this from the standpoint of the way America wishes it would go, unholy collaboration between and among the races. I don't know. That is the best sequence in the movie.
I want to talk a little bit about the music itself and the team collected to build this music. But while we're towards the end of the movie, let's do a moment on the sort of coda, the mid-credits sequence. And
the album, when it flashes forward
yes.
to 1992, which, as I was saying before we started recording, I think is crucially where Black Panther also begins in that same year. You get vampire Michael B. Jordan in his Coogee sweater with his, you know, multi-knuckle rings and his girl, and they're eternal.
Hailee Steinfeld in some door knockers. Like,
yeah.
And they pull up on grown Sammy, preacher boy, played by
Buddy Guy.
And they have this conversation that basically tries to tie a bow on a movie that doesn't really fit a bow. Like, John, what did you make of where he was trying to land that plane after sort of like what I saw as multiple aborted landings?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the blues legacy back in Chicago, right? Buddy Guy is I think often talked about as like one of the last available connections to that history. And I think I was maybe lightly offended, like I was almost like offended on the behalf of hip hop a tiny bit because it sort of posited, you know, Michael B. Jordan, the Stack character, now wearing a Coogi, incredible sunglasses, as you say, Hailee Steinfeld in The Door Knockers, although kind of dressed like a character from Grease also.
Yeah, that, like the costumes strange, there also didn't
strange
really land 50s, for me.
Late, like 50s, early 90s hybrid.
She's like a little rockabilly.
I kind of like the like Amy Winehouse-ishness of that.
So I think I understood that, but I don't like the idea that the Stack character and the Mary character are reflecting a musical evolution that somehow is painted as odds with
what the guy is
basically like.
It's hostile.
And the Michael B. Jordan character says that he was allowed to live if he left the purity of the blues via Sammy alone.
But it also means that he's the last guy at the last club in a city that's hundreds of miles from Clarksdale.
And yet Stack says that he loves the old blues. He loves the real.
Mm-hmm. He's like,
yeah, this electric stuff is not.
I'll give you one more chance if you want to join us, but if not, like, play me one of those old songs.
And he dusts off the guitar, I think it's a steel guitar. So he's embodying hip hop. He's dressed in the garb of hip hop, but yet is claiming allegiance to this.
But this is the
real
problem
legacy of music.
With the vampire as metaphor, right? Like it's like that doesn't feel good in a way that just doesn't feel good. And I don't know. I kind of liked the cleverness of what was being argued about, like hip hop as an iconography, mm-hmm. and that, you know, they're like, I don't know. I mean, you know, to take this conflation to its logical meaning, it's like that art form is also vampiric, right? It also is feeding off the art form and lifeblood of others. Yes. Vampiric. Yes. Same. I mean, these people who are dressed in a way that corresponds to a particular moment. I mean, the blues artists aren't dressed like this in 1992. I mean, Keb Moe's not wearing, you know, a Coogi sweater when he goes out and does his thing. Oludara is not dressed like that. His son is. And so I just feel like I loved looking at them despite what you guys think of what the clothes are doing. I found that to be so as close to Hype Williams in terms of how it's lit and colored, not with any sort of tinting that I could tell, but like the colors just popped in a Hype Williams way.
Yeah,
right.
Club scene.
But at the same time, like these people are still undead, and their job as creatures of the night is to like keep biting people and sucking their blood. I don't know.
I think he's saying that hip hop is as a corporate concern, selling blackness one way or the other is a form of compromise.
He's saying of course the vampires ended up here.
Yeah.
Like, of course that's who
I think
are.
What he's saying is, I want to make Sinners 2 in the 90s and wouldn't that be dope?
This is the other thing, because I do
we'll
think
be back
it's like,
in 2 years.
It's a clever use of the post-credit sequence, which is a thing
Easter
that Marvel
yes.
popularized in order to sell its next movie. And it is funny to think, like, is this a comment on that? Where he's like, I made a single piece of non-IP art, like, just live with it? Or is he leaving open the possibility that he will be part of the system again? Follow the money. If it's away from his original vision for what Sinners was as a self-contained piece.
To Reggie's point or thought, Coogler's been doing a lot of really good press, which is like maybe a silly way to put it, but it's like some people have just gotten good at giving interviews and like saying meaningful things. And he's very good at that.
He's very good at it.
And I think he was on The Breakfast Club and he was talking about struggling with essentially being a fan of rappers who rap about certain subject matter and then fall victim to the things that they rap about at a very young age. And he talked about someone that he works with essentially putting him on to grunge music. He's like, I needed to take a cleanse. Like, I couldn't keep listening to the stuff that was putting me in this mental space. Mm. And
he cited Nipsey, he cited Dolph.
Yes, right? Nipsey and Dolph specifically. And then he's like, so I went and I listened to all this other stuff. And it's interesting. He's like, I heard grunge, I heard white blues in it, so on and so forth, which I think certainly people at the time thought about a bunch.
But that's that great musical sequence, I'm telling you. I did not know this about the Breakfast Club.
Yeah, I just saw it this morning. Yeah.
That sounds right.
And this leads me into the last thing I want to talk about with you guys, which is like the team assembled to do this is also in these conversations. This is
they're the archivist.
Ludvig Göransson, mm-hmm. who you know, an Oscar winning film composer, Oppenheimer and Black Panther, but also
Childish Gambino,
the lead collaborator of Donald Glover for his entire career as Childish Gambino. Like, this is the guy making This Is America. This is the guy making Redbone, making funk music as a white Swedish guy, mm-hmm. collaborating closely with black artists. He's done every Coogler movie. You have James Blake here mm-hmm. working. Mm-hmm. That's another, you know, blue-eyed mm-hmm. soul, but make mm-hmm. it glitch, like whatever you want.
But again, he's the guy who's standing outside the juke joint and somebody inside is
yeah,
like,
yeah,
but he sounds good.
I mean, he sounds good.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
And then you have, you know, you have Rhiannon Giddens.
One of the musical consultants.
Who's mm-hmm. made her whole career, you know, basically doing Cowboy Carter, but for her whole career.
And speaking of the banjo, making an appearance.
You know, I'm saying it in podcast terms.
No, I know. Just a funny way to put with it. Beyonce on Cowboy Carter.
Yes, know what I mean. Yes, doing musicology.
After shading Beyonce. Yes. The first go round, yes. which I very struck by.
Rod Wave, a modern blues singer.
But also Kingfish Ingram.
In the band.
I mean, yeah, just, I don't know. I feel like
a legitimately great contemporary blues player. I mean,
mind-blowingly good at his job. Legitimately great. And also in awe of being on stage, probably for the 20th time with Buddy Guy, but like performs awe for the brief moment that we see him.
Yep.
How did the music work for you guys? Like both score and we've talked about some of the performances in this, which like I wasn't expecting this movie to be a musical, but it's like it's kind of a musical.
It's an action film. It's a musical. It's a buddy comedy. Like,
I could see this coming to Broadway at some point.
Yeah.
I could see a Broadway
for sure.
Oh my God, Reggie.
It's funny. We were talking about the music scene in the juke joint where you're crossing time and space and the sort of clunkiness of that. I thought the performance before that, where there was just in that time, this is what it sounds like. Pearlene, Preacher Boy's love interest, is singing. Preacher Boy is singing himself. That was one of my favorite scenes of the movie. I thought that worked really well.
What's her song called? Pale, Pale Moon? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think so.
I thought that the movie was really flying at that point. I thought that was a beautiful scene. And I will also say that thinking of like some of the heavy-handedness of the subsequent scene, It made me think of 12 Years a Slave in a musical scene in that movie that has always stuck with me.
It's a crazy scene where
Solomon North of Chiwetel Ejiofor, the character he plays, attends a funeral. And it's one of the most powerful, one of the only truly musical sequences in that movie.
Well, musical sequences for the enslaved people.
Right. Yes. Yes. And this old woman starts singing this Negro spiritual, and in that moment I feel like you get what this movie is doing, where you've seen the origins of slavery, you've seen the depths of it, you've seen the suffering, the oppression, and then in this one moment you see this beautiful thing that emerges from it, and it presages so much music that's going to come afterward, and you really get that in this kind of economical way, which is kind of a much more lean version of what I think Ryan Coogler is up to in this film.
It's interesting. I mean, I think that is very true. I have two thoughts about it. One is like, I would have liked one of those sequences at the end, or like one of the juke joint sequences, to be a full sequence that doesn't get interrupted or isn't there as padding for narrative stuff happening inside and outside and elsewhere in the club. Give me a number, right? A, and B, we have not talked at all about the Delroy Lindo character.
I was going to say.
Oh my God, yeah, how have we gotten this?
And who is, you know, a conflation of a lot of different people.
Yeah, and he's the old bluesman.
And there's this great moment. I've really had to train myself as a moviegoer to pay attention when an older character tells a story in a movie, or any character is like about to give you an anecdote. I'm always like, I don't know where they're going to go. Like the famous watch scene in Pulp Fiction where Christopher, I mean, I just like totally zoned out on the walking watch sequence, but.
Or the end of No Country for Old Men.
Just pick one, But this one, I was, I don't know. I've trained myself to pay attention now. I'm a better moviegoer.
And you're an older man.
I'm also an older man. And he tells this story about this lynching that takes place.
His partner, his former partner.
And there's a great moment where he tells it. And then I think he hits the side of the, like, he hits the side of the car. And we understand, like, a thing that Albert Murray has been writing about, you know, had been writing about his entire writing life. I mean, nobody's read any Albert Murray, by the way. This is a good moment to think about, like, what our one of our great American historians was like doing in permanently aligning American life, American spiritual, cultural, political life with the blues experience as invented by and proliferated by Black people. But Delroy Lindo is hitting the side of this car. And I just thought that was one of the smartest, deepest, subtlest choices to like do a work that, again, gets totally steamrolled by the explicit "this is what the blues is" stuff. That story, and then the beating, like the stomp on the side of the car, is the blues.
So Wesley, I think we should listen to one of those blues numbers. We're going to go out this part of the conversation. We're going to do a couple more minutes on the blues with another colleague. But what do you want to listen to on your way out?
Pale, Pale Moon, that sequence that Reggie likes a lot. I mean, as a moment, it's really nice. I mean, I don't know who that actor is, but she's wonderful and she's like got a really great physical presence. And she performs this song slinking across the floor at some point when she really is feeling it in the juke joint.
And on the soundtrack, it's performed by Brittany Howard.
What?
Reggie, Wesley. Thanks for talking Sinners.
You're welcome.
It was a treat.
Before we go today, we started with the filmic elements of Sinners. We moved into the musical elements of Sinners. And before we go, we wanted to add one more layer of detail and kind of analysis on top of that. We're joined now by James Thomas. James, what's up?
Hey, man.
James is a software engineer here at the Times and occasional contributor to the Culture Pages. And this week, James did a fill-in amplifier for our colleague, Lindsay Zola. Shout out Lindsay, who I hope is writing very swiftly, whatever she's writing right now, sort of inspired by Sinners. And taking the idea of almost like the blues mandate and widening the window and sort of trying to take in a much more ambitious range of music connected to and umbrellaed by this big idea. Before we get into some of what's on the playlist, because there's about 10 or 11 songs on there, before we get into that, tell us about in the movie. Was there a particular moment, a particular scene? Was there something that sparked for you that said, ah, I know how to build on this world? Because so much of what happens musically in Sinners is a question of like, is our world meant to be widened or is it actually best served cloistered? That's the kind of emotional tension that's happening in the film. But I wonder if you could talk about musically, what did you see on screen that then sparked where you ended up going?
I think Coogler is telling us that it is a necessarily wide world. There's a scene, it's not a spoiler
We've already spoiled the movie.
We're pro-spoiler on this podcast. It's fine.
Yeah.
If you're this far, you already know what happens in Sinners.
Yeah. So there's a scene where the main character, this prodigious blues talent, is at a party and it's his first time like showing his gift to his community. And he starts playing and it zooms out and suddenly and very seamlessly within this barn full of Jim Crow era sharecroppers that has been turned into a juke joint and is their place of release and catharsis as they are all just jubilantly dancing around. Suddenly you see like B-boys come in. Yep. You see like as the the guy's playing his guitar, you see an African griot playing his instrument, his stringed instrument, and it's synced perfectly with the music. So you're starting to see people from across generations, across musical eras enter the scene. And I mean, that's Coogler telling us that this is all interconnected. It shares a DNA, whether it was 1932 or centuries before, or the 1970s with Bootsy Collins on stage, like it's all connected.
And previously on this podcast, I would say we were nitpicking a little the filmmaking and the music in this sort of climactic
stretch.
But to you, musically, it obviously sparked something, like the idea. Like, what did you then want to put into your version of this history? Like, you made your own little mini canon here of blues influenced music that springs from a similar place.
I mean, again, I think the songs kind of do that on their own. Like, when we talk about blues, we're kind of talking about two things. We're talking about a pattern. We're talking about a very specific chord progression. We're also talking about a spirit. And those two things are not always present at the same time, but both of them can be blues. And so I just wanted to listen to songs that had both the pattern and the spirit.
Pattern and spirit is an interesting way of thinking about it, because this list that you made crosses genres, obviously, there's not a lot of what I would describe as modern blues revivalism. You're talking about an impulse. And I wonder if you could talk about a couple of the singers on this. D'Angelo pops up a couple times, which feels like kind of a given, dare I say. Mm-hmm. But also you've got Joy on here, who is incredible and maybe less well known. Can you talk a little bit about some of the singers that are embodying that impulse? And maybe even almost some of the vocal, like what are the gestures that come across so clean, like that tell that story?
Let's start with Joy, since you mentioned her. I mean, she evokes, man, like you hear Betty Wright in her so hard. Like she has even more range, and she has a more delicate voice. But like, you know, you hear Betty Wright and that particular flavor of blues-inflected R&B in her, it comes out of her pores.
And so, Joy, we should say, is from Atlanta.
Yeah.
Dungeon Family affiliate.
Yeah, you put Lick on here, features Sleepy Brown, as does the Outcast song you put on here from
Lucy
Speakerbox
Pearl,
like below.
Yeah.
If those words mean anything to anybody anymore.
I mean, like with hindsight and a time machine, I would have made a little bit more in the column of Sleepy Brown's appearance.
Oh,
on
yeah.
It. Like, it didn't even occur to me until I looked at it after the fact. But also Cecile McLaurin-Salvant is on there.
Mm-hmm.
And though she is not someone that we think of in like the traditional blues canon, she is absolutely perfect at embodying. When you see her live and she wants to evoke Nancy Wilson or Gregory Porter, like she knows how to use her voice, her breathing to like evoke them but not imitate them.
Mm-hmm.
She can channel blues as well as anyone.
You also have Tom Misch on here, which I think is funny, because like one of the things that we were talking about in the prior segment is there's this tension with the vampires in the film where it's like, oh, no, they're vampires, but they're kind of good. They can play.
Yeah.
And some of the people who are in the juke joint are maybe more prone to give the vampires a chance because of the quality of what they can do musically. And so, you know, not all vampires are made equal in this film. Not all, you know, there's a range of perspectives on how white folks interact with black music, how vampires interact with victims. That's a range. So even you including Tom Misch on here, I see you wrote through kind of like, I think they'd let him in.
If you have soul, you have soul. Like, that's going to come through in whatever you do. And his stuff is just compelling. Like, it just hits you. There's a question in the movie about like whether you have like the lived experience that's necessary to channel that. I can't speak to any of that with Tom Misch,
mm-hmm.
but the guy can play. Like he is evocative. He has it. He understands
and
it.
And you see that even within the bluesmen in the film, you have the sort of older generation being skeptical that the younger mm-hmm. performer has what it takes to live up to the tradition, given that. So you have that even intra-racially in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, Delta Slim, literally, when he's first talking about blues, like, he's almost talking about it as a discrete historical event that he lived through, but that nobody who was born after such and such a year could possibly live through. That's almost how the thought process was, but then obviously softens to the charms of Preacher Boy Sammy over the course of the film.
What's crazy is, for that particular part of the list, talking about white folks and like who has permission to participate in this culture, like, almost, there was almost another song that I put there, and that was Gold and Silver by John Wayne, the hip hop producer mm-hmm. out of LA, mm-hmm. who was another example of someone like, he just has it. Like, he, when he cooks a beat, like, he has a direction, he has a vision. I don't know where that comes from. And that would have actually been a more perfect one. I couldn't use it because we have to use things that are on Apple.
That have linked, that are linked, yeah.
Well, and then that, I think we should probably play that to go out.
Yeah,
you can find James's full playlist at The Amplifier, at The New York Times. That's our music newsletter.
Subscriber exclusive.
Oh, yeah. Is that true?
It is.
Yeah. Well, subscribe. If you're
subscribe to The New York Times.
Just, you know, sign up.
Keep us all employed.
Yeah. That's available. And James's full 11-song playlist. You can hear that on our website or in The Amplifier in your inbox. But let's go out with...
What's the name of the song?
Gold and Silver by John Wayne.
And that is our show. Thank you to Wesley. Thank you to Reggie. Thank you to James. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe. YouTube, Spotify, Apple, anywhere you get your audio content. We are also on Instagram and TikTok at Popcast. Joe made a link tree.
Oh, yeah. Linktree.com/podcast.
I mean, honestly, what more could you possibly want?
Shout out to Sammy. Sammy made the link tree, but, you know, I helped.
Very vampiric of you, Joe. I'm noting that. In the room, it's Nick Pittman. On the boards, at home, it's Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media with the production.